The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 under the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Hinckley Institute strives to teach students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. Hinckley offers internships to all majors here locally in D.C. and in 35 nations around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in D.C., and over $400,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is Gay Family Matters, with our guest Elizabeth Clement. But first, please join me in welcoming Patrick McShane, Program Manager at the University of Utah Muse Project.
Thank you. Good afternoon. On behalf of the Muse Project, the Hinckley Institute of Politics, the Office of Equity and Diversity, and the Gender Studies Department at the University of Utah, it's my pleasure to welcome you to this 2014 Women's Week Lunchtime Lecture. This year's theme, What Matters, focuses on the many challenges women face in their day-to-day lives and serves both as a statement and a question. Topics include work-life balance, finances, mentoring, and leadership. We invite you to attend a variety of the Women's Week events throughout the remainder of this week. You should have a postcard on your chairs in here that mention those, or you can visit diversity.utah.edu for a list of the remaining events. As mentioned, we're fortunate to be joined today by Professor Elizabeth Clement. Professor Clement received her bachelor's at Columbia University and then went on to receive a master's and PhD in history and a graduate certificate in women's studies from the University of Pennsylvania. Her first book is titled Love for Sale, Courting Couples, Charity Girls, and Sex Workers, and the Making of Modern Heterosexuality in New York City, 1900 to 1945, and focuses on how American understandings of the relationship between sexual activity and morality have changed over time. Her work received support from the Social Science Research Council and the Society for the Scientific Study of Sex. Her current book project titled We Are Family, Gays and Lesbians in the American Family, focuses on gay conceptions of family and broader American views on the relationship between gays and family from 1945 to 2010. We're excited to have Professor Clement, and please join me in welcoming her.
Hello, I'm sorry we ran out of pizza so early. I would like to begin by thanking Professor Porter and the Women's Week Committee for giving me the opportunity to think through why gay family matters. Like most public lectures, this talk is not my work alone, but instead draws on the work of many scholars. And if you're interested in knowing more about these scholars, please let me know, and I will provide you with a list of works that I'm not actually citing right now. So, when Professor Porter asked me to give a talk on why gay family matters, I had no idea that the task would be quite as relevant and honestly quite as personally painful to conceptualize and write as this has become. It has been a hard couple of months for Utah's LGBT citizens, and I have been startled by my own reactions of dismay and anxiety. I have now lived and worked in Utah for almost 15 years, and I have been extremely happy here. I love my job, I love my colleagues, I love my community. It is almost always a beautiful day in the neighborhood here. But it turns out that I have a remarkable talent for tuning out what I don't want to hear, namely the hostility and intense disrespect expressed by many lawmakers and many of my fellow citizens towards me and my family. Who knew I had such gifts? However, this year it has been impossible to tune out the hate. In this year, and quite miraculously in this place, gay marriage erupted into our lives, and for a few happy days, pandemonium rained down at the county courthouse. I was particularly delighted by the stampede of sympathetic clergy people who converged on the scene competing vigorously for the honor of officiating at the state's first gay marriages. The string quartet in the lobby was also a lovely touch. Who says gays won't change marriage? As you know, though, that particular joy was not ours to have and hold. Within less than 2 weeks, the state, using, I must emphasize here, my tax dollars, had asked for and was granted a stay in preventing any more gay marriages. The state also announced that it would not recognize the marriages that had already been performed. What I was unprepared for, though, was the way it felt and still feels to open the paper every day and see the ugly, hateful things said about our families spilling across the pages of the Trib. And not surprisingly, the social science literature validates these nagging feelings of anxiety and disquiet, the distrust these attitudes spark in me for my fellow citizens and my community. A study by Sharon Ratosky and her colleagues at the University of Kentucky analyzed 300 LGBT people's reactions to anti-gay marriage ballot initiatives in their states in the 2006 election. They found that having ballot initiatives related to gay marriage increased participants' minority stress, as expressed by higher levels of feelings of isolation, anxiety, and fear. As one participant explained, quote, "The vitriol of the debate was vicious and mean-spirited to LGBTs, which did bother me quite a bit. You'd think when you're 54 and have been out for 32 years, your skin would be leathery and able to deflect the bigoted arrows. But even for me, it stung quite sharply." In the wake of these debates, Ratosky and her colleagues found that participants felt alienated from their broader community and from their fellow citizens. As one stated, quote, "I find it upsetting that so many strangers who have never met me hate me and think of me as a second-class citizen." Another said, quote, "I feel like a stranger in a strange land, even among coworkers and friends who at least outwardly purport to be unbiased against gays." When, as happened in Utah in 2004 with the passage of Amendment 3, 66% of your fellow citizens vote against your right to form legal family ties, it's hard to remain cheerful and unparanoid. I feel the truth of these findings in this study every day. The state has cast some of its arguments in the recent marriage case in Utah in terms of harm. Particularly, it argues, an unspecified harm that will come to children should gay marriages proceed. If the state wants to make this debate over marriage about harm, then we need to remember that the debate itself already causes harm to our LGBT citizens by emphasizing how unwelcome we are and how unimportant our families are to our fellow citizens. This alienation leads to anxiety and stress. I was also totally unprepared by how devastated many of us were when the state flatly refused to honor legally constituted marriages. Friends who I hadn't even known wanted to get married were in tears when their marriages fell into legal limbo. And that limbo has taken more than an emotional toll. My partner changed her name with the federal government, but now can't get a state driver's license, and more importantly, can't change her social work license with the state. As she's in the process of opening her own private therapy practice, this bureaucratic limbo has become not just inconvenient, but frightening. What name should we purchase malpractice insurance under? We have friends who are trying to access spousal health insurance benefits and are being denied. We have friends who have been stopped mid-adoption, threatening one of the most basic of family ties, those between a parent and the child she is raising and has currently no legal relationship to. So this keynote became fraught for me, carrying as it now does that extra weight of the pain that currently reverberates through my community and through my family. And all of this made me realize that I couldn't actually answer the question of why gay family matters, because it matters too deeply to me. So as all professors do when they are in a jam, I cheated. I reached out to my fellow professors, gay and straight, and asked them why gay family matters to them, and I will use their responses to shape this talk. Law professor Laura Kessler wrote in an answer to my query about why gay families matter to her, quote, "Because a central means of oppressing disfavored groups in our society is to wage war on their familyhood." Well, as an American historian, I know she's right about that. The U.S. has a long tradition of withholding family rights to deny people citizenship and their humanity. The most wide-scale and devastating historical example of this is slavery. The system of chattel slavery in the United States defined people as property and denied them access to family relationships and thus family protection. This is not to say that they did not have family relationships, only that such relationships were not recognized in either law or social practice. Slave marriages did not exist before the law and could be broken by sale at the whim of the master. Slave parents had no say over how to raise their children or whether those children would be sold away or at what age. The denial of family rights emphasized that not only are slaves not citizens, but that slaves were not people at all. Slaves existed as kinless individuals, which made them that much easier to buy and sell. In the imagination of the Anglo-American slave trade, slaves existed as units of trade, as commodities, rather than as the people they actually were, embedded as we all are in complex networks of kin. That slaves lacked kin was a legal lie. A lie that becomes suddenly visible when historians showed that the most common motivation for running away from slavery was the threat of sale. That is to say, the threat of separation from kin. While racial discrimination and discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity have different histories from racial discrimination and should not be conflated, the denial of family rights is one area in which these histories converge. If you want to deny someone's basic humanity, deny their family rights. Deny the recognition of their relationships to kin. Strike them at the heart of where we all live in our families. Is that really what we want to do right now? Do we really see LGBT people as so far outside of humanity in our sexual and family values that we constitute a class not just of non-citizens, but of non-people? And speaking of citizenship, Professor Nadia Durbach of the History Department marched into my office and insisted that gay family matters because family rights go to the root of what it means to be a citizen. We should never, she insisted, create categories of second-class citizens. If heterosexuals can marry and receive extensive state benefits, she argued, then denying these rights to LGBT citizens creates a second tier of citizens, and by extension, a second class of families with diminished rights. This is not only unfair, she argued, it is immoral, and it degrades the value of all of our citizenship. In the U.S., regulating marriage has traditionally fallen to the states. However, in the 20th century, the federal government began to offer benefits to encourage certain kinds of families and denied those benefits to others. The Social Security Act of 1935 favored married families with a male breadwinner, a female homemaker, and dependent children, and it bestowed extra benefits on those families. For example, Social Security allows married men to claim a Social Security allowance for their non-working wives. Families in which both spouses work do not receive this allowance, nor do single-parent families. All families, through their payments into Social Security, disproportionately support families that follow that favored state model, taking money out of our pockets and redistributing it into the pockets of male breadwinner, female homemaker families. When it was passed, Social Security also discriminated against unmarried and divorced mothers, denying them benefits to aid to families with dependent children, while extending those benefits to widowed mothers. So here again, you see the importance of marriage in the way that the state distributes benefits. This occurred despite the fact that it could hardly be argued that children born outside of marriage or living in families broken by divorce needed these benefits any less. Families who cannot marry cannot collect the full amount of Social Security should one partner die. Currently, if a spouse dies, the remaining spouse can collect a survivor benefit from Social Security, and if there are minor children living in the family, can collect benefits for them as well. However, if my partner dies because we cannot marry, I would not receive that survivor benefit. Because current Utah law bans adoption by, quote, unmarried cohabitating adults, which was written to appear neutral but is clearly aimed at gay and lesbian, or actually LGBT people more generally and their parenthood, my partner and I, in 2008, moved to California. She quit her job, and she was able to adopt our daughter in California. We did this to make my partner's legal change to our claim to our daughter absolute. I did not want their relationship, that of parent and child, to be contingent on our relationship as partners, which is to say that if we had not done that adoption and we had broken up, I could have denied her access to her child because I was the only legal parent. And I really wanted safeguards against my own bad behavior. But I also feel that my child deserves a right to a legal relationship to a parent who helped to plan her and who is raising her. It should not be contingent on our relationship as adults. But honestly, how many people can do this, right? How many people can afford to quit your job and move to California for a year to establish these relationships? My friends whose adoption has been put on hold have the added problem that should the non-biological mother die, their daughter cannot collect her own Social Security benefits. Which is to say, the money that my partner and our friend have paid into Social Security over the years will not go to support their families upon their death, but instead will go back into Social Security to support other more state-favored families. The federal government also supports this family model in the tax code and its provisions around inheritance. Should my partner die, I will have to pay an inheritance tax on the home that we bought and owned together. If we could marry, that part of our estate would pass to me untaxed. Unlike most Western democracies, which base social benefits, social welfare benefits on citizenship, which is to say, for the most part, under birth, our federal government has chosen to tie our social welfare benefits to either work or marriage. This unnecessarily increases the value and importance of marriage because it makes marriage a major conduit for benefits that the state bestows upon us. In an email, Professor Porter pointed out that this discrimination between families that began during the New Deal has profound and negative consequences for society as a whole. There are costs, she argues, to not providing for families equally or providing families with equal access to rights and resources distributed by the state. Quote, when you deny rights and marginalize people and their children, she argued, quote, they have a harder time being productive members of society. I would connect her analysis here back to Ratosky. Minority stress makes you less happy and less productive, and thus, in a roundabout but also quite concrete way, affects your fellow citizens. Or to put this more personally, as a professor, my job is to instruct and guide this state's young people. When I am anxious and stressed and distracted by the legal status of my family, I am less productive and less effective in the classroom. My teaching suffers, and as a result, so do my students. Privileging certain family forms over others has a long history in the United States, and I think the time has come to question whether doing so really is a legitimate state interest. What do we gain as a society by discriminating between different types of families, by rewarding some and punishing others through the denial of legal rights and recognition and the differential support for some families and not others? Does the desire to maintain marriage as a heterosexual privilege outweigh the harm done to society by making its gay citizens less productive? Although Americans have seen gays and lesbians living outside of family throughout the 1950s, which is to say many Americans conceptualize gays as not part of families, throughout the 1950s and 1960s, many gay people did still have children. Most people who experienced same-sex desires in this era still married, some of them because they wanted the social recognition of marriage, others because they wanted to be parents and could think of no other way outside of heterosexual marriage to do this. Not only did the state not recognize the importance of those LGBT parents to their children, it actively sought to prevent them from having custody or visitation in the event of a divorce. As the work of Daniel Rivers and our very own law professor Cliff Roski show, from the 1950s through the 1990s, the family courts and straight society more generally believed that gays and lesbians existed outside of family, were incapable of family, of forming stable family ties, and were a danger to children. When they took children from queer parents, the courts reflected these societal beliefs that gay people raising children would either sexually abuse their children, conflating homosexuality with pedophilia, or would, through their example, somehow turn their children gay. And by the way, I'm sure most of you know this, but the vast, vast majority of people who sexually abuse children are heterosexually identified men. There is no data to support the idea that gays and lesbians are more likely to sexually abuse children. As it turns out, these particular fears were unfounded. We now have nearly 40 years of social science data on lesbian families that shows that children raised in lesbian families fare as well as those raised in straight families, and that they are no more likely to turn out gay. We have much less data on gay male families right now because gay men having children in the context of gay relationships is much newer phenomena than the lesbian baby boom, which began in earnest in the late 1970s. Even though there's no difference between children raised in lesbian families in terms of psychological or social adjustment and sexual identity, there are some small differences between them and their peers raised in straight families. My favorite of these is that children raised in lesbian families turn out to be more tolerant than their straight-raised peers, especially when it comes to gender nonconformity. So there are two findings. They are more tolerant in general, and they are particularly more tolerant of gender nonconformity. But I have to say, as a feminist, that is a difference I am willing to take. I am willing to run that risk in my family, that my child and my grandchildren will be more and rather than less tolerant. For a feminist, or really anyone interested in social justice, that is a win. When is intolerance ever really good for anybody? However, the assumptions behind these studies, that gay parents might produce gay children, does raise the question, would more gay people really be such a bad thing? Can we not sustain an increase in this population? And here I'm channeling queer theorist Eve Sedgwick, may she rest in peace. Are straight people simply by virtue of their sexual orientation really better than queer people? Does the state really have a legitimate interest in the sexual orientation of its citizens? Do straight people perform citizenship better than LGBT people? As a result of state and community hostility to gay parenting from the 1950s through the 1990s, any queer parent who wanted to maintain relationships to their children had to lie about their sexuality, hide their identity, and often abstain from forming stable partnerships. So it's actually very common in the custody cases in this era to see a judge, when they allow gay visitation or gay custody of children, to prohibit them from having partners at that time and prohibit them from exposing their children to their gay partners. In essence, LGBT people had to choose between one kind of family relationship, that of a loving commitment to a partner, for another, the relationship between parents and children. Unlike married straight couples, queer people could not form loving partnerships and be loving parents at the same time. Ironically, just as there is a lot of social science evidence that children in gay families turn out pretty much the same as children in straight families, there is extensive social science data that shows that lying and hiding things and having secrets are bad for you, and thus produce a cost for parents who lie, the children who are lied to, and as they grow older, in turn must lie about their own families. Data from children raised in these queer families indicates that they found staying in the closet about their families stressful, and that doing so caused them confusion and shame about the structure and composition of their families. It also made them deeply afraid that if they told anyone about their families, they would be taken away. Noelle Black, who grew up in the 1970s in a lesbian home, said that he was, quote, freaked out when his mother came out to him. As he explained, quote, there was an unspoken understanding that if other families in the neighborhood found out, I'd either get beaten up, taken away, or ridiculed. It has made me secretive and distrustful of anyone who got too close. Kids like Noelle were right to be afraid. From the Second World War through the 1990s, courts routinely removed children from the custody of loving queer parents. In fact, courts saw homosexual parents as so dangerous that they sometimes placed children with straight parents who had abused them rather than allowing queer parents to maintain custody. In a 1978 case in Mississippi, a court placed children with their father, even though he had, quote, beaten both Nancy and the child and had broken Nancy's jaw, unquote. In another 1982 custody ruling, the judge gave the children to their father, even though, quote, the children have been victims of sexual and physical abuse by their father, unquote. The fear of being removed from your family understandably terrified these children. Again, I think this issue, if we want to debate the state here, comes down to the issue of harm. Denying children in these families secure bonds with their parents clearly caused them harm. I also received at least two responses to my queries about why gay families matter that fit in with my understandings of the goals and analysis of gay liberation, a movement that began in 1969 at a riot in Stonewall, at the Stonewall Inn in New York City. Gay liberation did not actually initially support marriage as a goal for the movement. Viewing marriage as a patriarchal institution that oppressed women and children and reinforced negative gender roles, most gay liberationists rejected marriage. Instead, they applied liberation both to sexual identity and to family structure. All people, gay liberationists insisted, should be free their sexuality from the strictures of heterosexism and sexism. All people should be free to pursue healthy adult sexuality in whatever way they saw fit, and should attempt to eliminate oppressive understandings of what it meant to be a man or a woman from their lives and from their identities. Finally, gay liberationists argued that families should no longer interfere with the sexuality of children in their desire to promote heterosexuality. Children, gay liberationists believed, should have the right to form their own relationships to sexuality and their own relationships to their bodies. Gay liberation, rather than reifying homosexuality as an identity, would instead free everyone from the categories that bound us. Eventually, gay liberationists hoped the categories of gay and straight, male and female, would cease to be important, and we would all simply be free to be who we are and choose to love whoever we wanted. Professors Porter and Horn of the History Department and Latin American Studies tapped into this profoundly gay liberationist impulse when they argued that the diversity of families and diversity of sexuality should be valued as a positive good in and of itself. As Professor Porter wrote, quote, "I think about gay family as important within the context of a wide range of changes in family. Of course, a lot of people find this diversity of family and ways of living together precisely the problem. However, for me, the diversity is liberating, like there are many and not one ways to be. In this multi-ethnic, gay family matters because human diversity matters and should be celebrated. In this multi-ethnic, multiracial, and pluralistic democracy, we should not mandate that everyone be the same. Difference is a fundamental good, reflecting as it does the diversity of positive ways to be and act in the world. This diversity will give us and our children many more choices, leading to more rather than less freedom and fulfillment." In addition to an ideological stance that encouraged diversity of gender and sexual expression, gay liberation also relied on the practical strategy of coming out. In my current project, I argue that the gay community's strategy for gaining social acceptance has utilized actual and idealized bonds between family members. So here you have Sarah Bosser on the morning of 1987, October 11, 1987. She's about to go to the National March on Washington for Gay and Lesbian Rights, and she's holding up a little hand-lettered sign. You can actually see the Washington Memorial in the background. "We are your family, your coworkers, your friends. You love us already. What's the problem?" Coming out can challenge heterosexual family members to rethink long-held negative stereotypes about homosexuality. Once out, the lived experience of LGBT people in America exposes heterosexual kin to the depth of hostility and discrimination that we face. Embedding liberation in family relationships has been extremely effective and explains the rapid success of gay politics in the second half of the 20th century. As Professor Tice of the History Department and Asian Studies so succinctly put it, quote, "This is stupid. Everybody already has gay family members and we already love them. Gay people aren't dangerous to family, they are family." Or, to quote another very important expert on this issue, as Dumbledore said to Harry in the Deathly Hallows, quote, "Help will always be given at Hogwarts to those who ask for it." No, that's Chamber of Secrets. Hang on. Okay. "That which Voldemort does not value, he takes no trouble to comprehend. Of house elves and children's tales of love, loyalty, and innocence, Voldemort knows and understands nothing. Nothing. That they all have a power beyond his own, a power beyond the reach of any magic, is a truth he has never grasped." Taking our cues from Dumbledore, who J.K. Rowling recently identified as a gay man, it is love that we queers have deployed as the agents of our liberation. While coming out often comes at a very high personal cost for individuals whose families reject them, it has utterly transformed the perceptions of LGBT people. More than Ellen or Will and Grace, individual LGBT people coming out has been the single most important factor in the incredibly rapid shift in public opinion towards LGBT people. Embedded liberation in family relationships, as coming out does, also explains why Americans have made so much progress relating to issues of queer rights and so little in confronting racism or ending poverty at the end of the 20th century. After all, while many different kinds of families have gay members, far fewer are mixed race. Families with gay members cannot ignore homophobia, but white families can ignore racism and downplay its vicious effects. But if gay liberation fundamentally disapproved of marriage as an oppressive institution that promoted unhealthy sexual and gender roles, how and why did the LGBT movement come to embrace marriage as a goal? In the 1970s, gays and lesbians could largely ignore marriage. By the mid-1980s, however, the AIDS epidemic and the lesbian baby boom had made this position on marriage increasingly untenable. Both of these historical developments brought home the fact that all of us need to be recognized as families when we are on the borders of life and death. Routinely, partners of gay men dying of AIDS lacked any legal rights to make medical or caregiving decisions for their partners. They were sometimes not even permitted at their partners' bedsides. They also lacked inheritance rights, and thus often lost not only their partners, but their houses and their apartments that they had lived in for years, as those properties passed to straight kin of their lovers. AIDS produced a devastating crisis in gay families at exactly the moments of illness and death when people are the most vulnerable and feel the least able to cope. The lesbian baby boom raised similar questions, although generally in the more positive situation of birth and child rearing. Non-biological mothers could not make medical decisions for their partners or their unborn children, could not provide health insurance to their partners or their children, could not access parental leave to care for their children. Even more devastating, non-biological mothers lacked legal rights to the children they raised, and in the case of breakups, often lost custody or visitation of children they had parented for years. Furthermore, in cases when biological mothers died, her straight kin sometimes sued and won custody, removing already grieving children from the only family they had ever known and denying their access to the loving bond that they had formed with their non-biological mothers. And this often happened over children's objections and their desires to remain with their mothers. In one case I found from the early 1980s, after the death of the biological mother, the grandparents sued for and initially won custody of their granddaughter, Kristen, removing her from the care of her non-biological mother, Janine. As Kristen said in an interview with the judge, quote, "For Christmas, I don't really want a present. All I want is to live with her. That's my Christmas present," unquote. After Christmas had passed and she still was living with her grandparents, Kristen appealed again to the judge, writing, quote, "Dear Mr. Scoot, Merry Christmas. Love, Kristen. P.S. Please try your hardest to get me back with my mom before my birthday, January 31st. According to her grandparents, each time Kristen returned from visits with Janine, she would be depressed for several days. Quote, "Eventually I thought she might run away, might do something to get to her mom," her grandmother said. The judge in this case, after several years, finally acquiesced to Kristen, not her mother's, but to Kristen's increasingly articulate demands that she be returned to her mother, and the judge transferred custody back to Janine. Thus, by the late 1980s, it was clear that a lack of family rights seriously disadvantaged queer families, making our already difficult lives unbearably painful and frightening. Given the state's linking of various legal and economic rights to marriage, the LGBT community had little choice but to pursue marriage as a solution to our now very pressing family problems. Marriage became a goal precisely because it offered one-stop shopping. It would reverse the legal disadvantages we faced in forming families and protecting the family bonds we had already made. But even as the gay community came around to marriage, marriage itself had changed in ways that made gay marriage easier to imagine for most Americans. Which is to say, gays and lesbians needed to change their mind about the value of marriage, but marriage itself had already changed in ways that made gay marriage more culturally intelligible to many more of us than it ever had before. So I have several reasons why this happened or what happened. First, in the Anglo-American legal tradition, we have always privileged the rights of individuals to pick their partners. No matter how much it upsets your parents, no matter how much it upsets your racial or ethnic community, or your co-religionists. Marital choice has a long history in American law and custom, and in the 20th century, it became to be seen as a fundamental right. The idea of consent has been an important part of Christian understandings of marriage for centuries. However, not everyone in the U.S. has always had that right. Slaves could not marry before the law, and after the Civil War, many states passed laws banning interracial marriage. Over the course of the 20th century, however, legal restrictions on marital choice have largely disappeared. The most ringing endorsement of this change came in the 1967 Supreme Court case, Loving v. Virginia, which eliminated bans on interracial marriage. As the court said in Loving, quote, "The freedom to marry has long been recognized as one of the vital personal rights essential to the orderly pursuit of happiness by free men." See, it's about gay marriage, free men. Marriage is one of the most basic civil rights of man. See, men, see, right there. Under our Constitution, the freedom to marry or not marry a person of another race resides with the individual and cannot be infringed upon by the state, unquote. Another big change in marriage has been the decreasing importance of gender in structuring the rights and responsibilities of husbands and wives. By the late 20th century, marriage has become much more gender neutral before the law and much more egalitarian. Under common law, marriage in the colonial and early national period involved women losing all claim to her own legal identity. Coverture, also called the law of domestic relations, ensured that married women could not sue or be sued, could not own or will property, could not own her own wages or enter into contracts or legally represent herself. Spurred by the women's rights movement that emerged in Seneca Falls in 1848, for you gender studies people, that's first wave. I don't know what you are about waves. Why with the waves? It's called the women's rights movement. It started in Seneca Falls. Okay. In 1848, legal developments in the 19th century gradually changed these definitions, giving women more property and more custody rights over children. And in 1920, the vote. But it wasn't really until the 1970s and feminism, or as y'all like to call it, second wave feminism, that the last vestiges of coverture were swept away. For example, before the emergence of feminism, the law defined women and men's responsibilities in marriage differently. Before the 1970s, men had a legal obligation to financially support their wives, but not vice versa. This has now become a mutual obligation. Women and men still may play distinct and traditionally gender roles in marriage if they want to, but they are no longer legally required to do so. The law now views the responsibilities of husbands and wives as virtually identical. This is one of the many reasons that Professor Basso of Gender Studies and History sees gay marriage as valuable. As he writes, quote, gay families denaturalize certain masculine and feminine norms that we know of as culturally and socially specific, but that appear in popular discourse as timeless. Or, as Professor Kessler of the law school says, quote, although I would prefer to eliminate marriage as a legal status, I think gay marriage matters because of my naive hope that same-sex marriage would work to further degender marriage as a legal category and cultural practice. And honestly, it cannot help but do that. Having people of the same sex in a marriage, by definition, disrupts understandings of what it is that husbands do and what it is that wives do. Is my partner the husband because she's good with power tools and home repair? Or am I the husband because I make more money and don't wear makeup? Like, who's who? It's hard to say. Or are we both just partners using our unique personal strengths, and she might argue weaknesses, to make our families flourish? Finally, although the ideas about marriage and religion have often intertwined, the idea that marriage is primarily a religious matter has never been true in the U.S. First of all, marriage in the colonial period was almost always a civic and not a religious ceremony, which is to say that the state and not religious institutions presided over most marriage ceremonies, even in New England, where those wacky Puritans are. Second, and to me, most importantly, since many denominations allow gay marriage and many ban it, arguing that religion forbids the state from allowing gay marriage privileges one set of religious beliefs and denominations over another. Who's to say that before the law we must listen to the Catholics and the Mormons and not the Reformed Jews and the Unitarians? Using a religious justification for banning gay marriage is a violation of the separation of church and state because it privileges the views and policies of some religions over others. In this context, the issue isn't actually gay rights. It's whether the state can choose between different competing religious values and ideas. Of course, many of us queers remain ambivalent about marriage as a goal. I am deeply concerned that obtaining access to marriage will reduce the critical lens that queer people have brought to the institution. As it has been practiced in the United States, marriage has been an oppressive institution, particularly for women and children. And it certainly has promoted what I consider to be unhealthy sex roles for both women and for men. Roles that restrict our ability as individuals to grow and learn and express all aspects of our personalities. I am concerned that winning gay marriage would simply include LGBT people in marriage, extending to them a legitimacy and respectability still denied to other kinds of families. Why should my child, white and middle class, being raised in a comfortable two-parent household, have her family recognized and respected in ways that children being raised by single mothers or by grandparents or in foster care do not? Don't those families need our respect and our help even more than mine does? Aren't those children more vulnerable than mine? Don't they deserve more rather than less support from their neighbors, their community, and their state? Think of the children. Okay, can we have the next graph? However, children and marriage all remain embedded in our understanding as Americans of family, and we need to think very carefully about this. This overhead comes from a book, and I'm supposed to tell you, it's recently out in paperback, by our own professor, Claudia Geist, of the Sociology Department, and it's about which living arrangements we, as Americans, think of as family. These responses indicate the importance of marriage in our understandings of family, as well as, interestingly, the importance of children. As you can see, 100% of the respondents defined a married couple and their children living together as a family. Interestingly, when it came to single parents, children were actually slightly more important than marriage itself, right? So children are clearly at the core of how we as Americans define family. As single mothers and fathers with children actually counted as family slightly more than husbands and wives with no children. But ideas about sexuality trumped the presence of children for many people. While 83% of the respondents viewed unmarried heterosexual couples and their children as a family, only 66% identified lesbian couples with children as a family, and only 64% identified gay male couples with children as a family, which is also an interesting gender difference, right? There's a 2% gap between families that I view as essentially the same, indicating that somehow we also, at least in slight ways, associate women more with family than men. Not only do we value marriage highly and use it as an important criteria of how to define family, we also persist in seeing queer people as outside of family, even when they are raising children together. I think we need to ask ourselves why. Why is marriage so important to our definitions of family, and why does heterosexuality still seem to shape our understandings, even when it's patently obvious that gay people can and do raise children? And finally, why do we persist in seeing people in committed relationships without children as not family? Should we win this particular fight over gay marriage in Utah, and I do believe we will win it, I want us to remember that it is not marriage that makes a family. Families are not made by marriage, and they are often not made by blood either. Families are made by love and commitment and grueling labor and often very little sleep. While I am glad to see the patent discrimination that banning LGBT people from marriage fall, for all the reasons that I have given today, I would like us all to remember that as a society, we benefit from strong families, whatever their structure and composition. We all benefit from recognizing family bonds where we find them. Grandparents and aunts and single mothers and fathers and foster parents all can and right now at this very minute in this very state are raising happy, healthy children. And they deserve our support as they do that very hard job. Partners providing loving support to each other deserve our support, and networks of chosen kin help us all thrive in this difficult and unforgiving world. Defining marriage by marital status is, in Professor Tice's words, stupid. And I would add, ineffective and unproductive. It reduces rather than multiplies the benefits of family, and as a result, it impoverishes us all as citizens and as a nation. I would like us to remember, in the term of the bumper sticker that some of us have, that love and not blood or marriage make families, and that it is in our best interest as a society to define family as broadly as possible and to provide support for all families equally rather than privileging those families who have access to marriage. Thank you.
We now have plenty of time for questions, so if you have a question, please raise your hand and say your full name into the mic, so first and last name. And unfortunately, the mic only reaches about halfway, so I'm going to ask you to come up if you're in the back.
Good afternoon. My name is Nora Mohan, and then my major is political science. So my question is, do you think there is a circumstance behind that, like to become lesbian or gay, that maybe the environment that are around them, or maybe the family. So, and then I think, like, do you think the major concern is the children? And then also, do you think, like, maybe this kind of people who became gay or lesbian can change it, like, and be normal as other people?
Well, most of the social science data on sexual identity formation is, we don't know. We don't know what causes gay identity or causes people to have same-sex desires. It's very clear from the historical, and I have to tell you, the primatological research that lots and lots of humans and other primates, and possibly many mammals, experience same-sex desire and act on it. So we don't know why. We don't know where that comes from. It's not really clear. As Eve Sedgwick would say, though, the search for origins is often itself a form of genocide, which is to say we search for the reasons for something as a way of preventing it. In terms of parenting, it is very clear from a very long record of social science research that having gay parents does not make you gay. And I might add, in most of our experiences, having heterosexual parents does not necessarily make you straight, as my heterosexual parents would testify, right? So it's not clear where this comes from, and it's also clear that I think we need to rethink whether or not these questions even matter, and whether or not we really, as a society, have an interest in preventing more queer people from coming into being. Yes, sir. Ella.
My name's Carter Folger. As an academic and as an activist, what do you think is the best way to react to kind of the religious backlash of, I mean, as we come out and as we get more and more strides, we keep getting this increasing backlash against us for, you know, destroying the family, as it will. But what do you think is the best reaction to that?
Well, it kind of depends on what that backlash does, right? What form it takes. I mean, first of all, I think there is a big distinction that needs to be made between what individuals do and what the state does. And I don't think that religion and religious preferences belong in the public sphere. So I really resent as a Unitarian, that my religious values are not reflected in state policy. I value the separation of church and state, and I would like the state to get out of that business of picking and choosing which religious values it thinks it wants to support. It's totally fine with me that people have these religious values. It's totally fine with me that religions try to promote them, but they should not do so through the state. So that's my first thing. On a more personal level, I think you have to try to be tolerant. I think you have to try to get support where you need it, where you can get it. I think you have to be patient. My parents were terrible when I first came out, although, you know, in the range of like what parents are like in the 1980s when their kids come out as gay, it wasn't that bad. I mean, it was unpleasant. I was kicked out of the house. They threatened not to pay for college, but they never did because then I wouldn't have graduated and that would have been embarrassing, right? So I was totally benefiting from my parents' weird upward mobility education thing that they had going. But over time, they realized that this sexual identity didn't make me a different person. And I think that is the fear. I think, or it's one of the many fears. I think one of the fears that heterosexual parents have when their kids come out as gay or queer or trans is that that person who they have loved and who they have raised is different. And it's not true, and it does take time for them to realize, right, that they're not losing you in that way. But again, I need to stress that you need to get support from friends and other family. I mean, one of the things that made a huge difference to me was that my family from the beginning had a very expansive notion of what family was. And so I had aunts and fake mothers and uncles. I mean, I had all kind of people who, even though they weren't that happy that I was gay, did not freak out the way that my parents did and were very good about continuing to tell me that they loved me and providing support for me. I mean, in terms of what religions believe, that's part of the separation of church and state, too. Religions get to believe what they want to believe. And there's not a lot that we can or should do about that. Yes?
How's it going? I'm Michael Ferguson. I've got a question for you with regard to policy implementations, because I'm totally with you philosophically. But I'm curious whether you're mostly trying to precipitate a cultural shift in mindset or actually translate it into legal protections and privileges for families, because in America and in the West, so much of that is predicated on marital contracts. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious, what does that even look like to start to define familial, protected, legal family institutions apart from marriage? Has policy work been done on that? And what would be like a few proximate steps?
Well, I mean, you know, back in 2004 when Massachusetts legalized gay marriage? There was actually an interesting compromise that was offered that I am probably affected by the fact that I live in Utah, that I actually preferred, which was that we turn this over to civil unions. Now, here's the deal. Everybody gets civil unions. Nobody, heterosexual, straight, queer, whatever, nobody gets married with the state anymore. And marriage can then go to religion. And to me, that is a compromise that allows for religious freedom, right? It sort of deals with that whole Arizona nonsense that we just went through, that latest Arizona nonsense. But the problem is, I think the train has left the station on this one. The time to offer that compromise was a long time ago. And there are a lot of queer people who are not going to take civil unions as a compromise anymore. If people who wanted to defend marriage as a heterosexual institution wanted to do so effectively, they needed to do it a long time ago when they were still winning. They're losing now. And so the interesting for me is I would actually prefer civil unions. I don't think the state has any business deciding who is married and who is not. But that has to apply to everybody, and marriage has to get out. In terms of family support, I'm a liberal. I believe in a social welfare state. I believe that children should receive all kinds of benefits that they currently do not receive in the United States. And I think that those benefits should be distributed to those children as citizens, and sometimes even, I have to say, as non-citizens, rather than through marriage, right? Rather than through the legal relationship between their parents or the lack of that legal relationship. But unlike gay marriage, we don't seem to be going that way, right? We are cutting budgets, we are cutting food stamps, we are cutting Head Start, and none of that, in my opinion, is a good idea. And I do think that, for me anyway, society should be judged on how well their children are doing. And our children are not doing that well if you compare us to lots of other people and if you take into consideration how incredibly affluent we are as a nation. And so, for me, the social policy challenges are not really around this issue of gay marriage, which I think is going to be solved in a year or two, but instead around these issues of how do we provide resources so that all people, but particularly all children who are vulnerable, right, they don't get to vote, that all children have what they need to succeed and to be well and to be happy. And that, in my opinion, takes time and hard work, and it takes money, right? I hate the fact that my kid has 32 kids in her first grade classroom. It's just, it's wrong. And as a teacher, I know it's wrong because I know I can't teach effectively with very high class sizes, right? Low class sizes allow me to pay attention to my students and give them individual attention, which many of you in this room know means that I'm really mean on your papers, right? And I am. The only reason I can do that is that I have relatively small classes, right? So we need to really think about the allocation of our resources and what it is, what are our goals as a society. And if we believe that children need to be given what they need to succeed, we need to make up for deficiencies in family, we need to make up for issues of poverty and racial discrimination directed at families, then that means we need to put money there, we need to train people, we need people working on these problems.
Now, unfortunately, that is all the time we have. Please join me in thanking Elizabeth for an amazing forum.